This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
We've been talking a lot about Lucy. I've met a lot of fossils, known and loved a lot of fossils in my time writing about them. None as famous as Lucy. She's the first paleo rock star. I've been joking that she's the Taylor Swift of fossils. And we'll discuss that today. I'm really thinking a lot and talking to my editors a lot about why has she been such an icon, right? What is it about Lucy? She's not the only skeleton. She's not the oldest. She didn't invent the internet. You know, Lucy is really special. And why is that? We want to talk about that. And is she still, as other things have come in the picture, as special? And you've seen some of these slides. This is just to sort of show again what an icon she is. Not only did Obama see her, but Ivanka Trump saw her. Going to Deserves Awry, the Pope. She traveled to the U.S. Much of this you've seen already, so I won't go through the great details about it, but it's kind of incredible. There's a spacecraft named for her. And certainly she's a national treasure in Ethiopia, right? Tremendous pride people feel in Ethiopia. Many of you have told me, Carol Ward and others, about people saying, oh, Lucy person, you know, or, you know, just such an excitement about it. She's known around the world. One of the stories you might not know, which I think is really interesting about her fame, that Don didn't share, is, you know, Don travels a lot, and he talks to a lot of taxi cab drivers. And he told me that in France, he got in a taxi, and the guy asked him, you know, who he was. He said he was the discoverer of Lucy. The guy said, no, the French discovered Lucy. You have to be really special for the French to claim you, right? So I think that sort of takes that the next level. So why is she so appealing? What is it about her? We've heard today she is obviously a skeleton that is remarkably complete. We have 40% of her bones. She walked upright. She was incredibly well preserved at Hadar, which was, you know, better than a pyramid for preservation. I mean, those, you know, what luck that she, as Don said last night, had the courtesy to die in a place where she was so well preserved, as were other members of her species. There are lots of members of her species. We have males, females, children, infants. Fantastic, right? So you get a sense of who this, she comes alive. You get a sense of who she is. I have a great quote from Bernard. There he is over there. He said, you know, when we discovered Lucy in the beginning, it sort of wasn't fair. And what he said is, it's as if it's my birthday and I've opened my first present and it's exactly what I want. So you think that all the other presents will be as good as this one? Sadly, they weren't, okay? This is a very hard science, as a number of you in here can tell us. You know, finding a skull is amazing, but it's a lot harder to get it, to feel the connection maybe with a disembodied skull or a kneecap or a, you know, a different piece of the anatomy, right? It's a lot harder to tell, to talk about it. But here's a little female that was stepping out of the wilds of Ethiopia. And I have to say, her name, naming her, appeals to a deep, deep part of us. You know, we are storytellers. This is part of who we are as modern humans. There's been a lot of writing about this lately in Sapiens. Yuval Harari talks about how storytelling is our superpower, right? If you can tell the story of your origins, or if you can tell the story of the other group over there that was friendly to us once, maybe you can go trade beads with them and get food from them in times of famine. Or you can tell the story of the people to avoid. This was critical to our survival. It plays into our need for religion. That's what Sapiens is about, is really about storytelling, right? And before him, there was a wonderful book by Misha Landau, who was at Yale at the time as a grad student, who writes about narratives in human evolution, and she writes that all paleoanthropological narratives, the stories scientists tell about their fossils and the models that they put together, all those often approximate the structure of a hero tale. They include a humble hero who departs on a journey, goes through tests and transformations, may gain knowledge for somebody else that's helpful, and finally arrives at a higher state. I think we're hardwired to love these stories. And as a writer, I have to think every time I write a story, click on the internet. I'm competing with everybody else out there to get your eyes on my story, right? I want you to click on it. We talk all the time at Science, even though we're writing about science and we need to be accurate, we need to be fair. How do we tell a good story? What's the narrative, right? And this is a fun slide. One of my editors at Science, who is a huge fan of Kurt Vonnegut, and I'm going to call out Tom Jones here. Where's Tom? There's Tom, board member, who took a class I learned last night with Kurt Vonnegut when he was at Iowa in the creative writing program in the 60s, I think, yeah. So my editor, David Malakoff, one of my editors, loves Kurt Vonnegut. So he basically put the slide together of from a Kurt Vonnegut lecture of what are the formulaic narratives that we know and love, right? Nothing's really created out of the whole cloth. We're using stories that you know and love, that you've heard before, the man in the hole. So boy meets girl, I won't go through all these. Boy meets girl could be the Neanderthal in modern human mating story, right? It's either a really lovely story or it could be a story of rape, but it is one of the stories and one of the narratives. Lucy probably plays best into creation stories, and every culture has their creation myths and their origin stories, right? This is about creating identity. Us versus an out-group, another group, making a cohesive group. You have your origin story. And I think that's, I'm not saying that's what Dawn was trying to do or any of the scientists wittingly, but that's why these stories are so appealing, the story of Lucy's origins. And let's think about that for a minute. Her creation story is obviously the ultimate creation story. And these are just the books I pulled out to write this story that I happen to have on my in my bookshelf. So I got to dust, you know, pull out my old Lucy's. And some of these, several of these are by Dawn, one's by Yves Coppens. There are others in my collection. I just took a quick photo of these before I came. She's the little skeleton that could, from humble origins. She overcame adversity. She gave rise to all humankind, right? Her species took a step toward humanness in a higher state, walking upright better than the hominins that came before her, therefore able to adapt to different habitats, different foods, right? That let her evolve into a more human-like hominin, flexible and adaptive like us, on a road to a higher state, progress in the human family, a hero and a survivor. These are the best stories, right? And all this played out in Africa, where you also have wild animals and snakes and, you know, incredible conditions that are really romantic. Sometimes scientists like Dawn, I'm sure you could tell us long stories about the grief you got for writing popular books. I mean, they're fabulous, but scientists can be snobs about writing and naming fossils. They can be purists. Every science has their theoreticians and their purists who say you have to be very careful about popularizing science. Certainly Carl Sagan got trouble for this as well. I even talked to him about it at one point when I got to interview him. Stephen Jay Gould, you know, there's it's a mixed bag. I will say, as a writer and an educator, because I sometimes teach, it's so important to write good stories for the public to understand evolution. This is a time when the Gallup polls find that 40% of Americans think we're formed in this image, well, maybe not mine, but an image like this in the last 10,000 years, right? But now with Lucy, they know there's an African ancestor, right? There's a primitive female ancestor that doesn't look just like us. They can't tell you the date. They might even not even tell you where in Africa, but they know that we originated in Africa and that there are fossils there. These stories are so important for educating the public for so many reasons. I mean, just think about COVID. This notion of evolution was so important with viruses, right? This goes to our health. So, and also for training and attracting new scientists. I can't tell you how many scientists, okay, this is a little bit more the older generation, but got into science writing because they read National Geographic stories about Lucy, about the Leakeys, about different groups. This drew so many people in. It's now on the internet in different venues, but still very, very important. So this originally, though, was a fairly simple story. When we talk about Lucy, I'm using Fred Spohr's very simple slide here. Everybody else has these slides. You know, once upon a time, life was simple between 3 and 4 million years ago when we had afarensis giving rise to everything that came after that, right? That's a pretty simple story to tell. Lucy is the mother of us all. It's very appealing. The human family tree was quite simple. Now I want to talk about what has changed, right? Storytelling has changed and with all these new discoveries. We think about how to tell this story without getting buried in all the new fossils. How do we talk about this? This is another Fred Spohr slide he let me use. This is only between 2 and 4 million. But look at all these specimens. Now, I don't know if they're all species. I'm not the scientist determining that. People debate that. You know, we have very different views in this room. But now we have other creatures there at the same time as Lucy. We also have older fossils, right, that have been discovered. Ardipithecus is a remarkably complete skeleton as well. And I got to go to the Middle Awash. Johannes was there. And, you know, I realized I got great respect for how hard this work is. It's also hard at Hadar. It's hard everywhere else as well. But I remember learning with Ardi that if you touch it, it crumbles. It didn't come in the same beautiful condition as Lucy. And the truth is, most fossils aren't as wonderfully preserved as Lucy. And then on top of that, you've got to take these teams of researchers into these places that are remote. I remember we went into the Middle Awash, and we'd have to make circles in the desert to find our way back with the trek. This was the technique. And we'd go off into these fossil sites. You've got these large teams. You've got to keep them well. They can't get sick, so you use your work time really well. And then you've got to take days out to go negotiate with the local people. We had to go to a town a few hours away because of to get regain access almost every other year, I guess, to the site where Ardi was found. This is true in many of these sites, right? These are tough conditions, really tough conditions. So the fossil, finding the fossils is hard. But I mentioned that the initial appeal was, okay, we have older fossils now too, want to say that. It is important though, one more, sorry. I got caught up in it. Then we also found Lucy's ancestor, right? This, I think most people here agree that Anamensis is probably Lucy's ancestor, although now we know from Johannes that Anamensis lived until 3.9 million years ago, which means it could have overlapped the last of the Afarensis, which complicates how the speciation happened. You know, we don't have this neat, simple line from Anamensis to Afarensis. There was probably a population that did evolve to that or something in between, but there were still some more primitive groups around. So we start to get a much more complicated picture, which means you have to be careful. Every scientist in this room knows you have to be careful and not fall in love with your simple origin stories, because it always gets more complicated, whether it's speciation or other fossils out there. And I have to think about that when I'm writing it. Also, I want to do a shout out to Mia Leakey while we're on Anamensis. You know, she was one of the first women leading a team in Africa. She is an amazing fossil hunter. When I was there with her, she was 62, which at the time seemed old. Okay, it's not to me anymore. She would take a cup of tea and head out, and she would outpace everybody. And this woman truly was in love with the fossils she was excavating. I remember seeing her on the ground with a crocodile skull, talking about what a beautiful face it had, you know, for hours excavating this thing that she came across. I mean, it's amazing to see that passion in the field. It's really exciting. And Richard Leakey told me she was a better scientist than I am, which I think is probably true, right? She just was amazing. And she's alive, but she's not out in the field so much anymore. And one more story, because I thought I would tell some stories. This is a fun one. When we went to Kanapoi, I went with her and her grad student, Chalo Monthy, who's one of the Baldwin Fellows, like several other people here, and I'll come back to that. The Leakey Foundation spent some money on training Africans, and it's paid out big time. He was doing his thesis. He went to Kanapoi. He now has led his own teams. We didn't make it to the site the first night. We'd driven for 2 days. We had trouble with the truck, so they stopped in the middle of nowhere. And I noticed all the museum workers climbing up on top of the truck to go to sleep on top of the truck. And I said to Meve, she's laying a tarp out and putting her sleeping bags on the ground. I said, why are the museum workers going to the top of the truck? She said, scorpion, snakes, you know, they want to get bitten. So what about us? She said, if you hold really still, they won't bite you. So all night long, I was like this. I was getting tested a little bit. So I'm so lucky to get to be a guest in these groups, but sometimes it's hard. It can be, you know, you got to go in and not get sick, make sure that you're not getting in the way of the work, try to be a little bit unnoticed, fall in the background, and sleep if you can. So anyway, that was my little aside about Meve. We talked about the skull. The other thing that has changed is not only are there more species out there, but the methods. The things that's changed the most since I started writing about human evolution in 1990 are all the different specialists that work on these teams. You know, somebody counted up for me, I think it was Tim, 50 PhD specialists, the same as at Hadar and Lorenzo Mille. People are brought in with all these specialties, and you've got the geologists, the geochronologists, the people that type the volcano eruption, date the ash, walk the margins to see to tie in the stratigraphy, just to get that setting. Then you've got the paleobotanists coming in to tell you the plants and the aridity, how dry was it. They're putting the hominin in context. You can no longer publish a paper in Science saying, we have a new species, here it is, bam. You now have to say, How did it move? What do you know about it? But what was the context? What was the environment? What was the ancient habitat? And some of the most exciting projects right now, in fact, one that you guys are working on, Johannes and Kay and others here, are comparing Rwanzo Mille with Hadar and Leti Garau to say, why do we have more diverse species in Rwanzo Mille? What's different about that habitat when you only have, at this point, afarensis at Hadar? So I think this is incredibly interesting, right? Can you get clues in the past about why you have more species? So dating revolutions, I wanted to mention that. Also ancient DNA. Huge part of what I do is writing about ancient DNA, and I was lucky enough to get to go to Denisova Cave in Siberia with Svante Paabo and see the sites where in one cave, they got the DNA from a tiny pinky finger. When they sequenced it, it was like, oh my gosh, a new kind of hominin. And they'd only just discovered a few years ago that Neanderthals were not a separate species that gave rise to modern humans, but a species that was around overlapping with us that we interbred with. And everyone in this room has DNA from Neanderthals, which is fascinating. Many people on the planet, Asians, have DNA from Denisovans as well. So we know about these two, and they all lived in one cave. Something like 60,000 to a little over 100,000 years ago. And we used to think you could have only one species of hominin at a time, right? So here we have all of them in the last 200,000 years. And what I wanted, I'm just throwing this slide up there quickly because I wanted to say our ideas about modern humans have changed dramatically based on fossil evidence and the genetic evidence. There are lots of theories. I don't know what's right, but there's this notion now that modern humans didn't just arise in one place in East Africa 200,000 years ago. Instead, we're back to 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. Was there sort of some new traits that arose in one group and then interbreeding at the boundaries of populations spread those traits? I don't know if that's right, but we see really complicated speciation for Homo sapiens 200,000 to 300,000 years ago. This begs the question, was this going on earlier? You know, was this going on with ancient hominids? Was it more complicated how they speciated? Were they living with other kinds of hominins? Were they interacting at the edges of the populations? Were they having, you know, mating and having offspring? Ancient DNA doesn't reach back as far as Lucy and the earliest hominins. There's exciting new stuff coming from ancient proteins. They won't tell us as much as DNA, but they can tell us different species, and we hear rumors. So new tools coming up. This is my latest, this is the image I'm using of the human family and, you know, many of the species. You've been seeing this kind of image all day long, that there's a lot more complexity there. The other thing about DNA that has come up is what we know in the last 200,000 to 600, no, six, from the last 500,000 to a million years, there are ghost lineages. They're seeing DNA from things they don't know about. This is in the last million years. So what else is out there we don't know? You know, what wasn't, you know, Hadar is so well preserved. And again, I have another quote from Bernard Wood, who I'm going to abuse here today and keep re-quoting. And he said, you know, it's unlikely that all the hominins that ever lived occupied the circa 1% of the land surface of Africa where we happen to find fossils. So the new narrative, what is that, right? How do we tell this new narrative? And this is what has sort of been emerging. This is a Chris Stringer book, but I also think about this a lot. We're the lone survivors. Until 30,000 years ago, Neanderthals were here. And the little creature on Flores, Floresiensis, the little hobbit, was there until, I don't remember the current date. Was it 50,000, something like that? There were always, in human evolution, other kinds of hominins around, which is such a romantic image to think about, that there are, you know, other ways to be members of the human family. You know, some of them probably better, right? It doesn't mean that our ancestor was the best. But how do we interpret that? Either we were really remarkable, and our ancestors adapted extremely well, incredibly flexible, lots of ideas about that. Or we were also really monsters. We did in everything else, right? Whether it's disease or violence. So this is a really interesting, complicated story. When you think of modern human origins out of Africa, one of the most exciting things is to think about, you know, everybody in this room, no matter where you came from, are more alike genetically than two subgroups of chimpanzees. Chimpanzees today, the few we have left, retain far more genetic diversity as a genus than modern humans. But everybody who came out of Africa, the differences you see today are about adapting to different diets, habitats, climates, which is really interesting to think about, especially when you think about moving forward. So my last note, I also want to say cooperation. There's more cooperation, and now more Africans are studying. I want to make sure I say this. More Africans are leading teams and studying fossils in Africa, and we're talking tomorrow about how to help make that better. There need to be institutions in Africa. Everybody's thinking about this. Editors of Science think about this too. How do you make sure that this kind of work can be done there? How do we support that? And I think I did call out the Baldwin Fellows already. You know, I wrote a story 20 years ago about small grants given to Yohannes Haile Selassie, Zerai, Chalamanthi, and others that, you know, look at the results. I don't have to say too much more. So those are phenomenal programs. So I think we come down, the last question and what I was asked to say is Lucy an influencer still? Well, of course she is, right? Because Lucy is so recognizable. Everybody always remembers this ancestor in Africa. And look at the papers today. Still really interesting research. Kay trying to understand how, maybe we won't know how she died, but what happened to the first family. How did Lucy, over a million years of evolution, how did she adapt and change her species? Fascinating. How did she interact with other fossils? Lots and lots more interesting work. But I wouldn't say she's necessarily the Taylor Swift. I'd say she's the Joni Mitchell. She's an oldie but goodie, and she will still persist. So anyway, storyteller perspective.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.